This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the dysfunctional capitalist state, the legal apparatus of repression. On March 28th, 2010, New York Times headline, Obama team is divided on anti-terror tactics. Charlie Savage reports, senior lawyers in the Obama administration are deeply divided over some of the counterterrorism powers they inherited from former President George W. Bush. There has been a discussion for over a year in the Obama White House. The discussion turns out to be squaring the circle. According to John B. Bellinger III, who was a top Bush National Security Council and State Department lawyer, there's a change in tone, but the change in law has been largely cosmetic. There has been no change in outcome. This refers to the Obama administration considering who can be detained without trial as wartime prisoners. This is a very significant debate because what it does is establish in the Obama administration, as it had been in the Bush administration, that the president is claiming virtually unlimited power as commander-in-chief to detain all those he deems to be a threat. Ralph?
Look, Maya, what we're dealing with here is the underlying apparatus of repression, and it is not merely the question of the Obama administration, but the ruling class itself, which we are really attempting here to analyze and understand. And I want to make very clear that the emphasis and the thrust is about what underlies the politics of the persecution and prosecution of Lynn Stewart, which will be the thrust of this program. I suggest, Maya, that before we go further into the article on Obama's team, we should have Ralph do an update on where things are with Lynn. And we're happy to have Ralph, as always, with us. And Ralph, please.
Good morning, Ralph and Maya, or Maya and Ralph. It's a pleasure to be on the program. And the latest in the saga of Lynn in prison is this. In the last week, she has not gotten any mail in or mail out except for a few magazines and two letters from the Midwest. And these letters from the Midwest said, Ms. Stewart, we've been following your case, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And could you recommend any leftist training camps and groups that we should join? Now, understand, they vet all of the mail. That is, they read all of the mail going into Lynn Stewart. They allow these two letters in. She doesn't get letters from ministers. She doesn't get letters from religious people. She doesn't get mail from her friends and family. But she gets these two letters in. Will you recommend any leftist training camps for us to join?
Apparently, she's not getting the letters from me.
Exactly. So you see, this is the type of thing that goes on, and I think I had mentioned several weeks ago that she had sent a postcard for me to send with money in it to her nieces in Portland, Oregon. They end up in the prison with the $20 bill, and they censor the mail, and having cash in the prison is a violation. You can be censored for that. She has lost 90 days of phone privileges for a phone call made by a cellmate to tell me about her medical condition. She's sick and she left for the hospital and she's not back. She got 90 days for that. Her cellmate got 90-day phone suspension. And these three things, the cash that got into the prison that was addressed to her nieces in Portland, Oregon, gets back in and it's contraband. So she immediately went to the supervisor on the floor and said, how did this get here? Because if they had found it, you know, 2 seconds later, she would have been charged with contraband. And then these two letters come in from the Midwest, suggest trained leftist training camps to us.
We should explain, Ralph, that all money to prisoners goes through a prison fund, and then the prisoners are given credit, which they can use in the commissary and so forth. But there is no cash flow itself within the prison system.
Thank you, Maya. So this is where Lynn is. She's very upbeat. She has wonderful, wonderful cellmates, And as I have to shout out to them, thank you for taking care of my lady. It is wonderful because they know who Lynn is as opposed to the people in our government. And on the comment of Obama's powers, Lynn made a joke to me. I may have told it before. She said to me, well, Obama has helped us out today. And I'm saying, how did Obama help us out? And she says, now, if I want to see you, all I'll have to do is look up. And she was referring to preventive detention. And she says, who do you think is on the top of that list of preventive detention? Meaning that the way Obama is going now, any of us could find ourselves in jail without charge because they think they know what we're thinking. And it is a terrible thing that's happening in this country. But I do believe we have turned a corner, and I believe, Ralph, you're going to get into the case of the Guantanamo lawyers. So I'm going to give you time to do that.
Ralph, before you leave, give Lynn's address. The letters might not be getting to her now, but there's going to be a huge backlog of letters, and we know they've brought on extra staff to handle the volume. It's very important to keep up the letter writing to Lynn. It shows the prison system. It'll show the judge just how much worldwide support there is for Lynn Stewart and how we want our mother courage back with us.
Well said, Maya. It is Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, at 150 Park Row, New York, New York, MCC, Manhattan Correctional Center, New York, New York, 10007, 2S for 2 South, and her number 53504-054. They have been returning mail with all of this correct address. Write it again. Put your return address because Lynn Stewart answers every letter she gets. This is how she loves passing the time, talking to people who are supportive, and she wants to be supportive of you. So please keep the mail flow going. Know that Lynn's spirits are up, and they try to break your spirit in these places. They don't have a ghost of a chance of that with Lynn. That's why they tried to hurt her medically, because her spirits cannot be hurt. And you help keep those spirits up with your letters. Thanks again, Maya. Thanks again, Ralph.
Thank you, Ralph.
Ralph, in dealing with this article by Charlie Savage, it's important to note that Judge Bates had posed the question, what are the president's powers to detain people without trial? Ralph?
Well, Maya, the specific question that John Bates, the federal judge overseeing cases involving detainees in Guantanamo, asked, and what the New York Times calls a provocative question, does the new administration want to modify Mr. Bush's position that the president can wield sweeping powers to imprison people without trial as wartime detainees? And career Justice Department lawyers handling the Guantanamo lawsuits feared, according to the New York Times, that rolling back Bush's position would make it harder for the Justice Department to win. In other words, if you can't detain people incommunicado without due process, you can't win. And the new acting head of the department's Office of Legal Counsel, David Barron, a Harvard law professor, was worried that Judge Bates had given them too little time to devise the answer.
And what's interesting is that David Barron, when he was out of the administration, had written a lengthy law review critique of the Bush administration claims that the commander-in-chief can override federal statutes. But let's look at what happened in this year-long discussion in the Obama administration among the supposed civil libertarians now within the administration. The outcome reaffirms exactly what President Bush was doing.
Well, Maya, actually, the Obama Justice Department came back on March 13th with a more modest position than Bush had advanced. But behind closed doors, the New York Times reports, the debate flared throughout the summer when the Obama administration confronted the case of Belkacem Bansaya, an Algerian who had been arrested in Bosnia and was being held without trial in Guantanamo. He was accused of facilitating the travel of people who wanted to go to Afghanistan. A judge found that such direct support was enough to hold him as a wartime prisoner. So in other words, merely for facilitating the travel of people to Afghanistan, this man is being held incommunicado without any charges formally brought against him and without access to anybody. Disappeared. Now, it's interesting to note here that Harold Coe, the New York Times tells us, a former human rights official and Yale Law School dean who had been a critic of the Bush administration's detainee policy, became the State Department's top lawyer in June, and he produced a secret memo contending that there was no support in the laws of war for the United States' position in the Ben Saya case.
However, Ralph, he was contradicted by the Pentagon's top lawyer, Jesse Johnson, who is a former Air Force general counsel and trial lawyer. And most importantly, he was the top advisor to President Obama during the presidential campaign. Johnson produced his own secret memorandum arguing for a more flexible interpretation of who could be detained under the laws of war, now or in the future. In other words, Johnson was supporting the Bush position. What we have is a debate that emerged as a meeting, a very long meeting, with Barron sitting at the head of the table trying to formulate the position of the Obama administration. And as the New York Times notes, they decided on a tactical approach, essentially reaffirmation of the position that the president as a commander-in-chief has sweeping powers, that is, powers to put anyone in jail. Ralph?
I think the change in tone has been important and has helped internationally, said John B. Bellinger III, a top Bush-era National Security Council lawyer. But the change in law is largely cosmetic, and of course there is no change in outcome. Note this carefully, brothers and sisters. It's not merely cosmetic, but the debate itself is a charade and is cosmetic. At the end of the day, nothing has changed. On the contrary, the Bush theses about arbitrary detention stands. Even in detention matters, the New York Times reports, the Bush-era theories remain attractive to the Obama people. This January, two appeals court judges appointed by Bush, Janice Rogers Brown and Brett Kavanaugh, both of whom were at one point called too ideological, opened the debate by declaring in another Guantanamo case that the laws of armed conflict did not limit the president's war powers. And in classified briefs filed in detainee cases this month, the New York Times reports, the Justice Department, quote, adopted an ambivalent stance. It's citing rulings as a precedent while reasserting its own contradictory arguments that it's the laws of war that mattered. We'll see how cases develop, Attorney General Eric Holder Jr. stated in an interview in February. I don't think we're going to deviate. In other words, brothers and sisters, they're divided on anti-terror tactics. They're engaged in a facade of the debate, and the outcome is reinforce Bush, intensify the repression.
Ralph, let's go to the bottom line. In the case of Ben Said, the Algerian man who was arrested in Bosnia, far from Afghanistan, who was being held without trial at Guantanamo, and was accused of facilitating the travel of people who wanted to go to Afghanistan to join Al-Qaeda. The conclusion here, now there's no proof of this. This is just what he is being accused of.
Let me just say this. The claim that they were going to go to Afghanistan for the purpose of joining Al-Qaeda is entirely an attribution made by the government. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. All that they've got is that the man was helping people who were interested in flying to Afghanistan to do so.
Yes. That said, let's look at how they square the circle. They decided in the Office of Legal Counsel, because they found no precedents that would justify the detention as a supporter of Al-Qaeda, picked up far from enemy forces. So they asked the courts to agree that people like Mr. Ben Said should be looked at from another angle, that they performed functions that had made them effectively part of the terrorist organization. Understand this. They're not part of any organization. They have no proof that they're part of an organization. they're considered effective members. And this comes into a case in an article that appeared in The Nation April 2, 2009 by Professor Jean Theo Harris, a political science professor at Brooklyn College. It's a case that concerned one of her former students, a student who graduated from Brooklyn College and went to London, where he achieved a master's degree in international relations at the London Metropolitan University in 2005. His name is Saeed Fahad Hashimi, and he's being held in the Federal Metropolitan Correctional Center, the same place where Lynn Stewart is now incarcerated in Lower Manhattan. And he's there under extremely onerous circumstances with a SAM, a special administrative measure, on him that bars him from having any contact. The accusations against him are material support to terrorism. He let someone who was staying in his apartment use his cell phone. Ralph?
Under the SAMs, the same SAMs that Lynn Stewart is accused of breaching by virtue of the fact that she was communicating with her client and she was making press releases on his behalf. Under the SAMs, Hashimi is allowed no contact with anyone. No calls, no letters, no talking to other prisoners through the walls. His cell is electronically monitored inside and out. He showers and goes to the bathroom in view of the camera. He can write one letter a week to a single member of his family, but he cannot use more than three pieces of paper. He is forbidden any contact, directly or through his attorneys, with news media. He can read newspapers only portions approved by his jailers and not until 30 days after publication. He is allowed 1 hour out of his cell a day and is not allowed fresh air, but is forced to exercise in a solitary cage. The SAMs, as The Nation states, pose a significant threat to Hashimi's mental health and his ability to participate fully in his defense. Their severity caused a pall of suspicion depicting him as guilty before he even enters the courtroom. Moreover, through the Classified Information Procedures Act, much of the evidence against Hashimi is classified. He is not allowed to view the evidence against him in this trial. The lawyer that was approved for him had to go through CIA-level clearance to be allowed even to review evidence. Because of national security claims, Hashimi's attorney is forbidden from discussing the government's evidence with his client or with any outside experts who do not also have CIA security clearance. The Nation is very clear here. Evidence is denied to the lawyer, and he cannot discuss what evidence he has with his client. This is not a due process or an adversary proceeding. This is a kangaroo court with military and CIA control.
And what is the evidence? The evidence is all provided by a man named Babar, who was arrested in 2004, pleaded guilty to 5 counts of material support for Al-Qaeda. That material support was raincoats, ponchos, and waterproof socks. And he faces up to 70 years in prison for providing, supposedly, members of Al-Qaeda with socks. While he was awaiting sentence, he agreed to serve as a government witness in various trials in Britain and Canada, as well as in Hashimi's trial, and he is supposed to get a reduced sentence. So he'll say anything. The only evidence that has come forward so far and the centerpiece of the government case against Hashimi is that Hashimi allowed Babar, who happened to be staying in his apartment, use his cell phone. This is incredible. And what we have with the Obama administration and the discussions going on is destruction of liberties in the United States. We also have a judge in the case saying that the treatment of Hashimi, these special administrative measures which are driving him insane, are considered, quote, administrative rather than punitive, and thus they are constitutional. Ralph?
Maya, the entire structure through which people are entrapped and through which they are accused. There's never any evidence that they've done anything. Somebody's used a cell phone. The attribution of Al-Qaeda is arbitrary and entirely a government designation to inflame prejudice. Whatever it is that they claim to be Al-Qaeda has never been shown to be in evidence in any material way. The people associated with it are doing nothing more than facilitating travel. No opportunity to challenge or confront. Here on the 17th of March, the New York Times, defense cites entrapment and terror case. The man accused of masterminding a plot to blow up two synagogues in the Riverdale section of the Bronx was offered $250,000 by a paid government informant for his efforts. The informant, identified as Shahid Hussein, worked for the Federal Bureau of Investigation in other cases. Mr. Hussein posed as a wealthy representative of a Pakistani organization. He attempted to recruit people by dangling promises of large amounts of cash before them. During one conversation, the New York Times reports, James Cromitey, the New York man accused of leading the, quote, plot, unquote, quote, told Mr. Hussein he was out of state trying to make money. He expressed reluctance at joining Mr. Hussein's plan. He told him, I have no interest in this. Mr. Hussein, the FBI operative, replied as follows. I can make $250,000, but you don't want it, brother? What can I tell you? In another conversation, the Times reports, Mr. Cromitey referred to being told by Hussein to offer $25,000 to anyone willing to participate. If you can assure them that they're going to see that much money, they're going to go for it, Mr. Cromitey said, according to the documents. Mr. Cromitey, along with three other men who Mr. Cromitey recruited, were interested only in the money. They had no knowledge as to what exactly it was they were supposed to do, and absolutely no incentive or motivation, according to the Times, to make a plot against the synagogue or anything else. Every aspect of that plan from the beginning was that of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The defense lawyers in the Riverdale case said Mr. Hussein, on behalf of the FBI, controlled the plot from the beginning to the final stages. The government's money and supplies and Hussein's indefatigable efforts, without these, there is not the slightest chance that these crimes would ever have occurred, Suzanne Brody, the federal defender, wrote in one of her filings with the United States District Court. This is the paradigm. Every case we examine that is a so-called terror case, as the New York Times writes in another article, did Bronx terror plot originate with FBI? The manifest behavior of the government in question is that of instigating plots. They are the authors of the so-called terror operations, and they deploy them in order to create the conditions of repression in the United States.
Well, Ralph, a famous case is still going on, if you remember, the Miami terror plot, of which we did shows. In this case, they were hung juries twice. And the prosecutors are trying for the third time, even though they have no evidence, to bring this case to trial. And this was a clear case of entrapment. It was recognized by the judge. It was recognized by the jury. The government just doesn't give up. Ralph?
What we're leading up to here, and what is the burden of all this, is that the context for the trial and persecution and prosecution of Lynn Stewart is in the fake war on terror. The government's own operations, which were manifest in the Landmarks case and in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, government operations, FBI operations, and where are we then with respect to Lynn Stewart? Second Circuit denies en banc review of Lynn Stewart's sentence, as Mark Hamlet reported in the New York Law Journal. The light prison sentence given to disbarred Lynn Stewart following her conviction for providing material support to a terrorist conspiracy continues to divide the Second U.S. Court of Appeals. Three different opinions were issued by the circuit as judges staked out positions on how the court should review the 28-month sentence. Southern District Judge John J. Codal ordered Stewart to serve in 2006. The unmistakable message from five of the nine active judges is that Codal must impose a significantly tougher penalty on the 70-year-old Stewart when she is resentenced. The opinions were issued as the circuit announced it was declining to rehear en banc in total the ruling by a three-court judge circuit panel that was itself sharply divided over the leniency shown Stewart by Kotel, the article reports. Now, I think it's important for us to examine, Maya, just exactly what is the Second Circuit? What is this Court of Appeals that is making these determinations? That is determined that Lynn Stewart should serve not 28 months, but 6.5 to 8 years without the terror enhancement, and the judges in particular are demanding that a terror enhancement be added to the sentence reflecting her presumptive violation of the SAMs in a conspiracy to aid terror.
Ralph, that would put it at 30 years. Essentially, you have the Second Circuit calling for a 30-year sentence for Lynn Stewart. As Judge Kotel himself remarked when he was considering the prosecution's request for 30 years, they're requesting life sentence for Lynn Stewart.
The thrust of this is that Lynn Stewart is supposed to have conveyed messages to her client and to have issued a press release which violated the SAMs, or the Special Administrative Measures. Now, the Special Administrative Measures, as has been repeatedly pointed out, not merely prevents a lawyer from communicating with their client or disclosing evidence to them or discussing evidence to them, but the Special Administrative Measures, in essence, require a lawyer to spy upon their client. Because if the client in any way describes or discusses such things as the government would consider to be useful to the United States, the lawyer is obligated to report it. So what, in essence, we are doing is turning lawyers into agents of the government under penalty of being accused of being aiding terrorism and violating the Special Administrative Measures. This is a catch-22, which is totalitarian in its essence and eliminates the very pretense of due process or the trial with right of evidence and defense in the United States.
Ralph, let's again make clear, special administrative measures were instituted as federal regulations in 1996 and then modified later to be more onerous, are regulations that can be imposed by the Attorney General on prisoners. They are, such as we mentioned with Ben Saeed, or in the case of Hashimi, or in the case of the Sheikh, which deny prisoners varying levels of access to their families, to reading materials, access to the world at large. And these are imposed on the prisoners, and the attorneys for these prisoners sign affirmations agreeing to respect these conditions, these onerous conditions. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Dysfunctional Capitalist State, The Legal Apparatus of Repression.
Wall Street Journal, March 15th, quote, headline, Gitmo's Indefensible Lawyers. Legal counsel to the detainees went far beyond vigorous representation of their clients. Doesn't the public have a right to know? An article in the Wall Street Journal by Deborah Burlingame and Thomas Jocelyn.
Ralph, we should mention that Deborah Burlingame is a founder of Keep America Safe, which is this right-wing organization that has been attacking any lawyer who defends the Guantanamo prisoners.
She is the senior fellow of the CIA-run Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. So this is not a journalist. When you actually find out who it is that's writing this in the Wall Street Journal, these are intelligence operatives, advocates of the so-called war on terror, the very authors of the call for the totalitarian state.
And their position is that the Guantanamo prisoners, and also extend that to prisoners in the United States, should not be represented. And at the moment for Guantanamo, there are 400 lawyers from as many as 50 law firms, most of them pro bono, doing this work pro bono, and they're major law firms. These are law firms with billings of $100 million and who represent the capitalist ruling class. But in their pro bono work, they have been taking on the Guantanamo prisoners, the detainees.
The political significance of this is considerable in its bearing upon Lynn's case. What are they accusing the indefensible lawyers of doing with respect to Guantanamo? They were communicating with their clients. They consciously violated the SAMs. The article documents how the detainees were given information. They were given information, and it was published by Amnesty International. What is the charge against them is that they provided a document to their clients published by Amnesty International in the United Kingdom, and the title of the article was "Cruel Inhuman Punishment Degrades All of Us. Stop Torture and the Ill Treatment in the War of Terror," unquote. The pamphlet article, which describes the torture and maltreatment of detainees, was given to these clients in Guantanamo, and the government is in a stew about this. Majid Abdullah Al-Judi, the detainee in whose cell the brochure was found, told guards he received the brochure from his lawyer. An investigation by JTF Gitmo personnel revealed that Julia Tarver Mason, the partner at Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Barton, and Garrison, sent it to her client and eight of the firm's other detainee clients through legal mail, a designation for privileged lawyer-client communication exempt from screening by security personnel. Worse, the article in the Wall Street Journal continues, the investigation showed that Ms. Mason's clients passed it to other detainees. More than a dozen detainees received copies. And not only that, but the Amnesty International brochure handed out at a human rights conference in London was a public advocacy formulated to defend the victims of torture and maltreatment, not only in Guantanamo. In fact, in a sworn affidavit submitted to the District of Columbia District Court, Major General Hood did not equivocate when it came to the Amnesty International pamphlet. The very nature of this document gives tremendous moral support to those who would strike out against our country, said Major General Hood. It is not a factual report. It is filled with second- and third-hand accounts and photos of protests that were staged and inflammatory photos from Iraq and provocative story captions, unquote. You know what they're talking about, brothers and sisters? The torture at Abu Ghraib, the torture at Bagram, the torture that the United States visits upon prisoners across the world, which Amnesty has documented meticulously and which is now being made available by the attorneys violating the SAMs to their clients so they would understand that they're not alone, so that they would understand that there is protest about this, so they would understand that they do not have to submit to such treatment.
Ralph, Judge Joyce Hens Green, in a 2004 protective order, what's called a protective order, it's protecting the government. It's certainly not protecting the prisoners, the detainees. Prohibits the lawyers from giving detainees information relating to, quote, military operations, intelligence, arrests, political news, and current events, and the names of U.S. government personnel. And it's the names of U.S. government personnel which they would need in their defense. And this came out also, aside from the Paul Weiss lawyer, Miss Mason, and her team, it came out with other lawyers, the Washington Post reported, that the three lawyers who were defending Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the supposed Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, showed their clients photographs of covert CIA officers in an attempt to identify the individuals who interrogated them, and it's not just interrogated them, who, if you recall, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded time and time and time again. And so it's the CIA officers who tortured them. The lawyers that were working for the John Adams Project, which was formed to support the legal team representing the so-called Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his and the other people who supposedly were working with him, they provided the defense attorneys with the photographs. And none of the attorneys under identification were identified by the Washington Post, but this is again considered against the judge's order. So it's the preparation for the defense. They were providing them with photographs so that they could figure out who was torturing these detainees. Ralph.
The Wall Street Journal article documents that the attorneys for the detainees in Guantanamo provided them with information about the nature of the war in Iraq and the nature of the war in Afghanistan. The attorneys, in fact, decided that their clients had to be allowed to understand the context in which they themselves were being held in such horrendous conditions and the illegality of that behavior. In fact, Wall Street Journal complains bitterly about the fact that that one of the attorneys, Jennifer Daskal, a former attorney for Human Rights Watch, called the Guantanamo Bay Military Commission's kangaroo courts. And one of the consequences of the detainees being allowed to know that they were being defended and that that there were organizations such as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International that were documenting and protesting these the torture and the inhuman conditions imposed upon people in Guantanamo and elsewhere was they went on a hunger strike. And one of the consequences of the hunger strike is that they refused forced feeding. And the article in the Wall Street Journal says that the refusal on the part of the detainees by forced feeding and the hunger strike itself is the result of the violation of the SAMs on the part of their attorneys. That is the nature of their role as defense lawyers, to advise their clients and inform their clients. And that is the gravamen of this headline in the Wall Street Journal, Gitmo's Indefensible Lawyers Flash. None of them has been prosecuted.
That's right, Ralph. None of them are accused of violating the judge's order that restricted the material that could be given to the detainees at Guantanamo. Unlike Lynn Stewart, prosecuted and persecuted.
What is the Second Circuit? Who are the judges on it? One of the judges that has led the charge demanding greater sentencing and enhanced terror content to the sentencing for Lynn Stewart is John M. Walker, Jr. I think it's important that we begin to look at these judges, what they represent, and what their agenda is. John Mercer Walker is a judge of the United States Court of Appeals. He is the cousin of George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, first cousin. He was appointed by them. He served in the Marine Corps Reserves from 1963 until 1967. And from 1966 to 1968, he was the state counsel to the Republic of Botswana under apartheid. You got it. He was the lawyer representing the Bantustan in apartheid South Africa, Judge Walker. He became Assistant Secretary of the Treasurer, responsible for law policy and law enforcement and regulation, with oversight of Customs Service, Secret Service, Federal Law Enforcement Training Centers, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the Office of Foreign Assets Control. Now, there are particular facets of Judge Walker that have some bearing on what we are discussing today, brothers and sisters. On the evening of October 17, 2006, Judge Walker was driving home and he struck a police officer named Daniel Pigagli in New Haven, Connecticut. The officer was directing traffic at road construction. He had been wearing a black raincoat and a reflective vest. Police Chief Francisco Ortiz said police officers did not find it necessary to test Judge Walker for drugs or alcohol. Let's just look at this a moment, brothers and sisters. Judge Walker hit a police officer and killed him. The officer, Dan Pigagli, 38, was hit while working, directing traffic in the rain on Tuesday night. The Associated Press reports on October 23rd, also in the New York Times. Judge John M. Walker of the United States Court of Appeals was heading home from work at the time and was stopped at the accident. The police said they found no reason to detain him, no reason to charge him. There is a publication called Above the Law. In its article called The Wheels of Justice, Judge John M. Walker hits police officer in traffic accident. David Latt reports the following. Police sources said Walker was the driver of the sports utility vehicle that struck Officer Dan Pegagli, who died. Police investigating the accident stated they had no reason to test the judge for drugs or alcohol, or to detain him, or to charge him. Justice, brothers and sisters?
Ralph, Robert Sack. Robert Sack has been a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. He took senior status on August 6, 2009, and he specialized during his 33 years in practice in national and international press law. What's most interesting about Judge Sack is that he was a partner in the firm of Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler from 1964 to 1986. He overlapped with Judge Michael Mukasey. Judge Michael Mukasey, who was the judge for the original Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman trial in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. Judge Mukasey and Judge Sack, overlapping partnerships at the same law firm, and yet Judge Sack did not recuse himself from the Second Circuit opinion. I would call this a conflict of interest. We have to look at the firms on which these judges serve as partners. Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, also Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, and the other firms. They represent the largest corporations in this country. They represent the Wall Street firms, the banking interests. This is the ruling class that these judges serve. Ralph.
Yes, they represent AT&T. They represent American Express. They represent the American Stock Exchange. They represent the major automobile companies and banking firms in the United States. They are the advisors to Lehman Brothers during its crisis in which the banking crisis unfolded. They are the representatives of General Electric and its $2 billion acquisitions. That's who Sachs is. That's who Mukasey is. And Mukasey, let me point out, is the judge, as we've indicated before, who not merely sentenced Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman to 100 years plus life, but Mukasey is the judge who presided over Jose Padilla, in addition to which Mukasey, with his long association with Rudolph Giuliani, was the author of the article in the Wall Street Journal and the advocacy that those who are responsible or accused of terror, those who are accused of violating the security of the United States, are not entitled to due process. There should be a parallel, or what he called an inferior judicial system specific to those accused of violating the security of the United States, where they would be treated as mental deficients, no due process, no trial, indefinite detention, by the way, backed by both Republicans and Democrats for the nomination and for serving as the Attorney General of the United States.
Ralph, another Second Circuit judge who didn't write a specific opinion, but he was part of the en banc ruling, although he didn't make his positions known explicitly, is Richard C. Wesley. He was appointed by George W. Bush to the Second Circuit. You found an article in the New York Times dated December 4th, 1996, that has some revealing information about Richard Carl Wesley.
During the O.J. Simpson case, William Gleyberson reports in the New York Times, Justice Richard C. Wesley was jogging near his home in New York and made it clear to a friend that he disapproved of what he considered Judge Lance A. Ito's permissiveness. Boy, if I was there, there wouldn't be any of this monkeying around, said Judge Wesley, according to the New York Times, with reference to the O.J. Simpson case. No monkeying around, no facade of a defense. Always a staunch supporter of the death penalty, the New York Times tells us, Justice Wesley has sometimes expressed fury at criminals. During a death penalty debate in the Assembly, he referred to Lemuel Smith, who had been convicted of killing a prison guard, a black prisoner. Here's what the judge said with respect to this.
This is when he was serving in the New York State Assembly.
The death penalty is necessary because of animals like Lemuel Smith who have no respect for human dignity, quote unquote. Animals like Lemuel Smith? This racist figure who proposes as a judge on the Second Circuit, who is one of those beating the drum for the incarceration for decades of Lynn Stewart, practicing law as an aide to the Republican leader of the Assembly, an open and an unabashed racist, and a person who, by the way, of course, was appointed by George W. Bush. The character and the case of Wesley and Walker and Sachs is only the little beginning. Judge Rena Ragy, a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, nominated by President George Bush, Ronald Reagan, Alphonse D'Amato, chief of the Narcotics Division handling drug prosecutions, Special Prosecutor's Division for the Eastern District of New York handling large-scale prosecutions before being nominated by President Ronald Reagan as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York. On the recommendation of U.S. Senator Alphonse D'Amato, nominated by Ronald Reagan to a seat vacated by Frank Altomare, confirmed by the United States Senate. Again, these are the figures who are judging Lynn Stewart, not merely judging her, but railroading her. How about Jose Cabranes, a Puerto Rican federal affairs special counsel to the governor of Puerto Rico, the first Puerto Rican in the court, and his relationship to Puerto Rico is to advocate for the not merely the special counsel to the governor, but to address federal affairs, which is submission to the United States suzerainty over Puerto Rico, known as the Puerto Rican Federal Affairs Administration General Counsel. And it should be pointed out that this is the liberal on the court, appointed by Clinton and supported by Carter and recommended by Senator Abraham Ribicoff. It was Carter who nominated Cabranes to the United States District Court and Clinton who nominated him to serve on the Second Circuit and whose role in Puerto Rico was to represent the interests of the United States in dominating Puerto Rico. How about the Chief Judge, Dennis Jacobs of the Second Circuit, the firm that he represents, which is Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett, headquartered in New York City, employs over 800 attorneys in 8 offices worldwide. The firm has special relationships with the private equity firms Blackstone Group, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America. Yes, brothers and sisters, Simpson Thatcher is consistently the most profitable law firm in the world on a per-partners basis. The partnership earned $2,875,000 profits per partner. It ranks at the top of all surveys with respect to its representation of the major corporate and banking firms in the United States. It's not only the Chief Judge, Dennis Jacobs, who is part of this firm, but so is Guido Calabresi of the court. The relationships between these judges and those rulers who have a stake in the war on terror and on shutting down attorneys who defend those falsely accused is manifest. This is not a judge or a court of people who are merely administering the law. On the contrary, they are not administering the law. They are engaged in a judicial rant about terror, terror, terror. And they are accusing Lynn Stewart of being engaged in terror for violating what are called the special administrative measures, which deprive a lawyer of the opportunity to represent the interests of the client or to utilize the public media as an arena in which to discuss or to advance the case, or for that matter, the interests and aspirations of the client they are obligated and committed to defend. And here we have Peter Hall, who is also a member of the court, appointed by George W. Bush, written opinions on the United States versus V. Guang Wang, an immigration case, long active in opposing immigrants and their rights in the United States, nominated by President Bush to the Second Circuit. And how about Gerard E. Lynch? Judge Gerard Lynch was actually the first lower court Obama nominee confirmed by the Senate. And Judge Lynch is, by that criterion, considered to be a liberal on the Second Circuit, joining with the others in what? In demanding enhanced tariff considerations for Lynn Stewart, the agenda shared. A nominal division between so-called liberal and conservative, vanishingly small, if non-existent.
Ralph, the Second Circuit decisions don't find anything wrong with the trial itself. Over and again, all they say is that there might be a procedural error made by the judge because he didn't consider whether or not Lynn Stewart committed perjury when she affirmed that she would follow the special administrative measures. And they also refer over and again to a terrorism enhancement whereby Lynn Stewart would have received a 30-year sentence. However, if you go back and you read the sentencing by Judge Kotel, Judge Kotel explains his reasoning for how he derived his sentence, which he reveals at the end to be 28 months. There was no reason to consider perjury because the enhancements already were at the limit and Lynn couldn't receive any further sentence. And he considered the terrorism enhancement. He said that it, quote, it applies. There's evidence that the defendant's actions were calculated to affect the conduct of the Egyptian government through intimidation and coercion. These are Judge Kotel's statements as to why he says the terrorism enhancement applies. And he says that the defendant violated the SAMs, and he gives his reasons. But then he says, quote, it's the extraordinary personal characteristics of the defendant that argue in favor of a downward variance. And he gives legal justification, Ratibulli 452, F3D at 153. He has given a full justification for his sentence of Lynn Stewart.
Maya, the fundamental issue here with respect to the special administrative measures is that they are violative of the rights of the defendant. They are violative of the Fourth and Sixth Amendments of the United States Constitution. They are incompatible with free speech entitlement, both of lawyer and defendant. And I want to emphasize again, the man, along with Judge Sachs, who has been beating the drum for a no-nonsense attitude towards crime, is Judge Walker. Let me repeat. Judge Walker. Judge Walker, driving his car, strikes a police officer wearing a black raincoat and a reflective vest. He kills the officer. The police do not charge him. He is not charged with involuntary manslaughter. He is not charged with vehicular homicide. He is not accused of having drugs or alcohol. Why? Because the police decided not to test him for drugs or alcohol. He is neither detained nor charged. Can you imagine, brothers and sisters, the consequence for anybody here, you, me, or anyone, let alone some black kid who would be driving a vehicle and killed a cop under similar circumstances? That is the meaning of this. Brothers and sisters, we cannot isolate the case of Lynn Stewart from the underlying politics and the structure of power in the United States. We cannot pretend that the judges on these courts are somehow insulated from their full political role and the reasons why they are appointed in the first place. We cannot fail to examine what is the underlying context of their rulings with respect to the rights of defendants in the United States and their exemption that they apply to themselves in every respect. This is the politics of the ruling class. This is the underlying meaning of the attacks upon Lynn Stewart and upon the rights of all of us. If we are to defend ourselves and to defend those rights, we have to examine who is doing these things, what is involved, what are the stakes, who rules, for what purposes, and what our own interests are in the forthcoming struggles in the United States in standing firm, in being clear, and going forward.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Dysfunctional Capitalist State, The Legal Apparatus of Repression, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net.